Mass shootings have shaken communities across the globe. One in Australia is prompting policy change.
Obviously, what happened on Sunday night is absolutely tragic, and there's a huge appetite to make changes where possible.
Another in the U.S. took the life of a Portuguese scientist.
He's being remembered as a brilliant scientist that still had a lot of work to give.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, the fallout from both incidents. Also, a sound that brings back memories for Vietnamese refugees.
The sound of the sea, the waves, many of us would use that to put us into sleep. But for both people, that was a sound that they don't want to hear anymore.
Plus, note to bartenders, Saudi Arabia is hiring. That's all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. All this week, people in Australia and the U.S. have been coping with fear and anger after mass shootings in both countries. We begin today with news updates on the two stories. In the U.S., authorities say that the deadly shooting at Brown University last weekend and the murder of an MIT professor in Boston are connected. The suspected gunman in both attacks was found dead late last night. Police identified him as an immigrant from Portugal, Claudio Valente. The MIT physicist he killed is also from Portugal, and that is where we start today. Reporter Sofia Neves is with the newspaper Público in Porto, Portugal.
We are all very, very shocked about what happened. Ever since we got the news that the professor was killed, we began covering this story. And we were more shocked evenly when we learned about the identity of the suspect that was responsible for his killing and also for the attack in the Brown University.
How is this professor, Nuno Lorejo, being remembered this week there in Portugal?
He's being remembered as a brilliant scientist that still had a lot of work to give. He was currently at the center of a potential revolution in nuclear fusion. He's being remembered not only for his work, but also how he was as a person, how he treated his colleagues and also those who worked under him, his students, everyone that contacted with him. Remembers a kind person, and he had a very natural ease with which he could establish collaborations and bridges with everyone around him. And that's what got him so far, because he began working in Portugal in a very respected institution. But when he got invited to go to MIT, that is a very important institution in America, he quickly rose to the top and became director. So everyone is remember him as a great person, a brilliant scientist, and a very premature loss for Portugal and also for the scientific community.
What has the conversation been like, or the questions raised, now that it is clear that the alleged shooter was also Portuguese?
Yeah, there has been a lot of curiosity about the relation between these two men, if they knew each other, if they crossed paths when they were studying, and if they had crossed paths ever since, because they were both living in the United States. We are still discovering a lot of details. So there are a lot of questions that are being asked, but mainly about the relationship between these two people, these two men.
We know that these two men overlapped at school, university in Portugal for a time. Is there any more information about if or how well they might have known each other?
What is confirmed is that Valente and Loureiro attended the same academic program at the university here in Portugal, in Lisbon. It was between 95 and 2000. But we don't even know if they were acquaintances, if they were friends, if they even spoke to each other, and if they did, if they had contact when they were both living in the United States. Our police has spoken about this, but they did not reveal any possible connections between Loureiro and Valente, and also the institute that they both went to also talked about this, but they did not give any public information about the suspect. They only talked about the good work that Nuno Loureiro did all his life.
Stories of gun violence are unfortunately not uncommon in the U.S. I imagine they are less common there in Portugal. I'm curious to hear how Portuguese folks are reacting to these shootings with that in mind?
Well, yeah, gun violence in Portugal is very much less prevalent than in other countries and in the US in particularly. It has shown a recent increase in the last few years. We have some cases, but they are isolated cases. When cases like this happen, they are usually related to disagreements between friends or family. We have no cases of strangers opening fire in public places. And also our laws regarding guns are a little bit strict, so we do not have a lot of cases like they do in America, like the one we saw at Brown University. But yes, we are obviously shocked that this happened with a Portuguese citizen.
What else are people talking about there as this all unfolds?
Portuguese people are very interested in what happened in this case, what led the suspect to attack not only the Brown University students, but also what led him to drive to Nuno Loureiro's house and kill him. They are curious about the relationship between the two, if they were friends, if they still talked, if they maintained any contact at all, as we don't know what caused the killings. They are very much curious to know what happened.
That's reporter Sofia Neves from the newspaper Público in Porto, Portugal. And now to Sydney, Australia, where we began the week just after a shooting rampage at Bondi Beach during a Hanukkah celebration. 15 people were killed and dozens wounded. Since then, Australians have been gathering to grieve the victims. There's also been a political response.
The terrible events at Bondi show we need to get more guns off our streets.
That was Prime Minister Anthony Albanese calling today for a national gun buyback. Daniel Losurdo is a reporter at the Sydney Morning Herald. He joins us with the latest. Daniel, let's start with this announcement from Albanese. What is this gun buyback program going to look like?
It's going to be a scheme which allows people to return their guns so they can be destroyed. This mimics a scheme announced by former Prime Minister John Howard in 1996 following the absolutely awful Port Arthur massacre, which killed 35 people. So it's a measure aimed at essentially curbing the number of firearms that are out on the streets.
So reduce the number of firearms that are out there. Albanese has announced other policy changes too. Can you tell me more about those?
So on Thursday, our time, he announced his 5-point plan, so to speak, to combat anti-Semitism. One of the measures used to crack down on gun ownership. There'll be wide-ranging laws which will be developed over our summer here. They'll be done to clamp down, rather, on hate preachers, so people who are spreading hate or inciting hatred in the community and sowing social division. There will also be measures, or greater measures, put into Home Affairs Minister Tony Burke's hands to reject or deport visa applications for people who he suspects may be importing hate into the country.
So how are these changes going over with the Australian public?
Most of these plans, or at least the legislation, are still in the works. Both the federal government and the New South Wales government, that's the state in which the Bondi attack occurred, both of them have appeared receptive and collaborative to these reforms. The devil is in the detail,
right.
So we'll see where it goes in that regard. But look, there's obviously what happened on Sunday night is absolutely tragic, and there's a huge appetite to make changes where possible to certainly, at the very least, minimize the prospect of this occurring again.
I want to focus in on Sydney's Jewish community and those changes that you're talking about to try to prevent the rise of anti-Semitism. There's a clip I want to play for you. It's from the daughter of a Holocaust survivor who was at Bondi Beach on Sunday and was wounded in the attack. Here she is.
Is this enough now? Will you listen to us? Albanese, Wong, will you listen to us? Will you actually do something? Will you actually... I don't have to stand up and say anything because we don't believe you anyway.
That was Victoria Teplitsky. And you can hear both pleading for action in her voice and also, you know, kind of a resignation to inaction. Had there been calls to tackle anti-Semitism that had not been addressed up until the point of this shooting?
Yeah, that's certainly a viewpoint which is being taken by some members of the Australian Jewish community. And there is definitely a sense of resignation and pessimism, I would say, in regards to the appetite from the Australian government to add measures that will curb anti-Semitism. And of course, that lands squarely at the feet of Anthony Albanese and Foreign Minister Penny Wong, who was mentioned in that clip. Of course, the Australian Jewish community is not necessarily homogenized. Different people have different views. But there definitely is a fraction of that community who are deeply upset and are of the viewpoint that this has occurred as a result of inaction from, of course, the Australian governments, but the community at large.
Obviously, the community is deeply grieving. How are Australian Jews processing that grief this week?
Yeah, of course, it's been an unbelievably difficult week for the Jewish community, as it has been for Australians as a whole. We've seen several of the 15 victims farewelled in funerals across Sydney and Melbourne this week. Quite unimaginable scenes, really. For example, the 10-year-old Matilda, the youngest victim of the terror attack, was farewelled during the week, and earlier that day, if I'm not mistaken, 87-year-old Holocaust survivor Alex Kleitman was also farewelled. So unimaginable to bury, your father, your grandfather, who escaped the Holocaust as a young boy, only to be gunned down and killed in a terror attack decades and decades later. So awful scenes in Sydney this week.
I understand there's been some criticism of Australia's government claiming that senior leaders have not attended some of these funerals. Is that true, and what has been the response from the Albanese government?
Yeah, that's correct. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese was not at some of the key funerals this week, and that occurred while, senior members of the federal opposition, for example, attended, and former prime ministers attended. So there were naturally some questions as to Albanese's attendance. Albanese's defence was that he would go to funerals if he was invited, and of course these funerals are deeply personal occasions, so there were some appetite for some families to keep it close and within that Jewish community rather than inviting any sort of political dignitaries.
Sure. More broadly across Australia, how have people's feelings of safety or vulnerability at large public gatherings or in public places been impacted by the events on Sunday?
Yeah, it's summer here, so people go to the beach with friends, have picnics by the water, all those sorts of lovely things. And there has been, understandably, a level of concern. But that being said, people have generally been encouraged to go about their plans as per usual. The New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns, has been strong and has made a point of backing the police force, saying that action has been swift in the days following and that people can be rest assured, as they go about their Christmas plans, that the police will respond to a threat where assessed and take swift action.
I want to end here by giving our listeners an update on the 43-year-old Sydney fruit shop owner, Ahmed Al-Ahmed, who tackled and disarmed one of the gunmen in the shooting on Sunday. He is still in the hospital. Here is what he told the BBC about what he did.
When I do save the people, I do it from the heart.
He said there, when he saved the people, he did it from the heart. I understand there's been quite an outpouring of gratitude, including, I understand, financial support to pay his hospital bills. Is that right?
Yeah, of course. So, yeah, as you mentioned, Al Ahmed has, within the span of a week, become almost a global household name. And I guess off that viral video, he's attracted $2.5 million from more than 43,000 worldwide donors.
Wow.
And that novelty check was presented to him in his hospital bed just the other day. And yeah, it's obviously quite a remarkable story. He was very gracious in accepting it. He noted that he did it from the heart, and I think he'll be an Australian hero for the rest of his days.
Daniel Losurdo is a reporter at the Sydney Morning Herald. He's been speaking with us about responses to Sunday's mass shooting at a Hanukkah celebration in Sydney. Now, if you need some music, we've got you. A Klezmer revival just ahead. You're with the world. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Ukraine this morning finally got what its president has long sought, a funding deal to keep the country afloat and continue fighting against Russia's invasion and occupation. EU leaders meeting in Brussels had wanted to hand Ukraine Russian assets currently frozen in Europe, but that plan was killed at the 11th hour. Belgium opposed it out of worries that it would be illegal and Belgium itself would face Russian retaliation. The arrangement EU negotiators could agree on is a $105 billion interest-free loan to Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the funds will be used for the defense of Ukraine. And in the unlikely event Russia makes peace, then Ukraine would use the funds for reconstruction. Klezmer is the instrumental music of Eastern European Jews, and it provides the perfect soundtrack for this sixth night of Hanukkah. The klezmer repertoire has grown by leaps and bounds in the past few years, in part as the result of access to an archive that had been sitting in a library in Ukraine. More than 1,000 tunes from the Kiselhof Makhnovetsky collection are now being taught, recorded, and performed in klezmer circles. Reporter John Kalish has the story.
We begin this story in Erfurt, Germany, about 150 miles southeast of Hanover. An 80-piece amateur orchestra there is playing a klezmer tune from the Kiselhof Makhnovetsky archive before an outdoor crowd of 3,000. The tune is titled Hannah's Skatchna, a lively klezmer dance number. It was named in honor of Hannah Ochner, a 33-year-old klezmer clarinetist who digitized some 600 tunes from the Kiselhof Makhnovetsky archive. Ochner has a PhD in physics and a day job doing research on electron microscopy in Cambridge, England. She started digitizing tunes during the COVID lockdown.
Nobody had anything to do at the time. You couldn't go out to a jam session, play with people. In the evening, you couldn't practice at home because they're neighbors, so you can digitize tunes.
Ochner is one of dozens of klezmer musicians involved in the Kiselhof Makhnovetsky Digital Manuscript Project, or KMDMP as it's known. The project has been working on close to 1,400 klezmer tunes from five East European countries. Some were collected in the seminal Anski ethnographic expeditions during the early 1900s. The rest are melodies composed by a Russian klezmer violinist who played at Jewish weddings. The KMDMP volunteers digitized hundreds of pages of sheet music, making the tunes available on the web for anyone to download. Klezmer musicians involved in the KMDMP have been playing through the melodies together during Zoom sessions led by Christina Crowder, a New Haven accordion player who heads the Klezmer Institute, the umbrella group that started this digital humanities project. Crowder says this klezmer treasure trove demonstrates that Jewish musicians in the early 20th century were influenced by music outside the Jewish community.
The Kiselhof and Makhnovetsky corpus shows us a much broader engagement of these musicians with the contemporary social dance music of the places where they lived. And that includes folkloric music as well as social dance, such as mazurka and polka and quadrilles and waltzes.
Music from the KMDMP has been recorded and released by several klezmer bands in the last couple of years. One album, titled Of a World That Is No More, features an Italian duo that includes the classically trained clarinetist Angelo Baselli.
I don't have a Jewish family, but instantly I fall in love with that music and I start to search recording. But at that time it was a little bit hard because there wasn't a klezmer movement in Italy. I start to play this music more seriously since 2015 when I been in London at the Klezfest. This is my klezmer story.
Klezmer Klezfest is just one of several klezmer and Yiddish culture festivals in Europe and North America, where the Kisselhof Makinoveski tunes have been spreading. One of the klezmer veterans who teaches in Europe is Susie Evans, a British clarinetist who's performed as a soloist with the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. She's been dubbed the Queen of Klezmer Clarinet. Evans and her klezmer partner went through hundreds of the tunes in the Kisselhof Makinoveski collection.
Initially, the ones you know stand out. But then later, it was the ones we didn't know that stood out, because they were the ones we would start to teach people and say, oh, we found this great new tune. If you're teaching klezmer music regularly, you're always looking for tunes that someone who's coming to the workshop and knows a lot of tunes won't know.
Evans divides her time between the UK and Germany because her accordion-playing partner, Sylvia Charanko, is based in Hanover. Evans and Charanko have recorded a double album of these Kisselhof Makinoveski tunes.
Wherever we go, we like to spread these melodies. We like to teach it to people, and it works because people do play these melodies they heard from us. In jam sessions in different countries, people play them in London, people play them here in Germany. People in Australia are playing them too now because they were in our workshop. The tune starts to come back to life when you play it. That's really nice.
Charanko and Evans have taught the Kisselhof Makinoveski tunes at Yiddish Summer Weimar, one of the world's premier Yiddish culture events. The repertoire is gaining traction here in the United States as well. The New York-based record label Borscht Beat, regarded as the leading distributor of klezmer music, recently released an album by a Bay Area klezmer trio called Voretsky Pass. The ensemble's violinist says culling melodies from the Kisselhof Makinoveski archive was like digging through the ashes of a lost Jewish culture. For the World, I'm John Kalish.
This show is getting ready to celebrate a major birthday. We have been on the air 30 years as of New Year's Day, and we want to hear from you. Head to our website, theworld.org, and tell us what the world means to you. That's theworld.org, and click the banner you see there to send us a note. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The online ads for bartenders at luxury hotels might look ordinary to an outsider. This one here for the Four Seasons wants applicants who are able to prepare a range of beverages, engage with guests, keep the bar clean and organized. What is surprising, though, is the location, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, where the search for bartenders is new. The conservative Muslim country is loosening its ban on alcohol. The world's Shirin Jafari is here to explain. Shirin, we will get to that loosening of the ban in a second, but just for background, what have the laws been like for alcohol in Saudi Arabia?
The Saudi government officially banned alcohol back in the 1950s. And besides the religious reason, you know, alcohol is not allowed in Islam, there was something else that led to this ban. In November 1951, a British diplomat called Cyril Osman was holding a party at his house in Saudi Arabia.
So this was a party with alcohol before the ban was enacted?
Yes, it's not like it was widely available before that, but it was tolerated in some circles, like, for example, for diplomats. So back to the party. A member of the Saudi royal family, Mishari Abdul Aziz, was at this party. According to some reports available from that time, Mishari had already had some drinks, but he was asking for more. Osman, the host, refuses to pour him any more, and Mishari gets angry. He leaves the party, comes back with a gun, and kills the British diplomat. The event sparked a whole controversy and led the Saudi king at the time to ban the sale and consumption of alcohol in the kingdom.
Wow, that is quite the backstory. So since then, was it basically impossible to get a drink in Saudi?
You know, I mean, there's always a way to get something that's banned if you really want to, right?
Sure.
So when I was in Saudi Arabia a few years ago, I heard from people who live and work there that they were able to find alcohol through connections and that alcohol was served in some private parties and gatherings. But this new shift opens the door for more legal ways of buying alcohol in the kingdom, both in some stores and in some high-end hotel chains.
So what is the Saudi government saying about these changes?
There hasn't been any official announcement. Remember, this is a pretty sensitive subject in Saudi Arabia, which is a conservative country. But the people that I spoke with told me that foreigners who have what is called a premium residency can purchase alcohol now. And these are high-paid foreigners who can get this premium residency by paying something like $200,000. That allows them to live and work in the kingdom. There are different versions of this premium residency. So if you are one of those people, you get a government-approved app on your phone, and that tells you how much you can purchase. So there's a limit also to how much you can buy. And there are a couple of designated places where alcohol is sold to these people.
So still highly controlled. Why is income the deciding factor here on who can buy alcohol and who can't?
Again, no official explanation on this, but I spoke with Andrew Lieber, who teaches at Tulane University and is an expert in Saudi politics.
For now, the Saudi government really wants to limit who is able to enjoy this. There were already substance abuse issues in the country. They don't want this to be widely available and leading to issues of public drunkenness that might be otherwise hard to control.
The substance abuse issues that Lieber is referring to are mostly related to a drug known as Captagon. That's an amphetamine-type stimulant, which is the most widespread abused drug in the kingdom. But going back to alcohol, Lieber said that the target audience for this change is foreigners who might not come to Saudi to work unless they're able to buy alcohol legally and on a regular basis.
Oh, okay, so this is kind of an incentive to attract more foreign workers to come to Saudi Arabia, this loosening of alcohol rules.
Yeah, exactly. And remember, Saudi Arabia is competing with other Gulf countries that are a destination for some of these workers. Saudi Arabia wants to attract these people to come and work in the kingdom.
So how are people in Saudi Arabia reacting to these changes?
You know, it's difficult to get Saudis to speak with foreign media, especially on a sensitive topic like this. But I did speak with two bartenders. They didn't want to be recorded. They told me that they both started working in one of these high-end hotel chains. Again, not going to mention the name of the hotel. They started working a few months ago. One of them told me that he worked in the hospitality industry in Jordan for 7 years. But then he started seeing job advertisements for bartenders in Saudi, and he decided to apply. He said the pay is higher than what he used to get, so he's happy with the change that he has made. The other one told me that he was in Saudi Arabia working as a barista at a cafe, but he decided that he wanted to become a bartender and he wanted to learn a new skill.
So this change is, as we've talked about, partly attracting foreign workers. Are there other reasons that Saudi Arabia is changing its alcohol rules right now?
Yes, this is not just about being more open and friendly to foreigners, but also about a vision. The Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has made it his mission to move the economy away from oil. And so the country has been aggressively investing in other areas such as tourism, tech, and so on. Andrew Lieber from Tulane University told me that there is an economic incentive for this as well.
It's not like people are getting discounted liquor at these places. They're paying a hefty markup over what they would pay back home. And that means revenue that's going back to the Tax and Customs Authority in Saudi Arabia.
One last point, Caroline. In the past, some people who lived in Saudi Arabia used to make short trips to neighboring places like the UAE or Bahrain to buy or consume alcohol. And it would be interesting to see what impact, if any, this will have on the sale of alcohol in those places as well.
It's something interesting to watch for. The World's Shireen Jafari, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And now we are headed to a place with a delightful name, Prickly Pear East Key, a private island that is also a habitat for a rare species of iguana in the Caribbean. Just a decade ago, there were zero Lesser Antillean iguana there. Scientists from nearby Anguilla wanted to save the species from extinction, though, so they brought over 10 of the bright green reptiles to start a breeding program. Now the population of Lesser Antillean iguanas has surpassed 300 on Prickly Pear East Key, one of only five places on Earth where the animal is making a comeback. The biggest free trade agreement in the world was supposed to be signed this weekend. The agreement between Europe and four countries in South America, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, and Paraguay, would give South America more access to European markets and increase European industrial exports to South America. But after 25 years of work on the deal, it has been delayed thanks to opposition by European farmers. Nicolas Saldias is an analyst at the Economist Intelligence Unit.
In theory, this should be an easy win-win for both of them, but it's proving a lot more difficult.
Right. Trade agreements, never simple things. Why is it not coming together as expected? What is the roadblock right now at this turn in the story?
Well, one of the reasons why it's taken so long to get to this point even is because there's a lot of opposition within Europe. Europe has a large agricultural sector and large protected agricultural lobbies. France is right now leading the charge, so to speak, against the deal. Macron, who otherwise is known as an economic free marketer, is opposing this. And recently, Giorgia Meloni, who's the prime minister of Italy, announced that they would be joining France. And so when she said that, it started a whole wave of controversy with Lula coming out the other day saying that if it's not done now, it won't be done as long as I'm president of Brazil.
Brazilian President Lula reacting to those comments from Meloni, and that's kind of what derailed the signing for this weekend.
That's correct. So Lula gave an ultimatum to Europe. The ultimatum worked in the sense that Meloni called Lula, or they had a conversation, and she says, give me time. We'll get this done January.
I want to go back to the agricultural industry in Europe, which is against this. What specifically are their concerns?
So Latin America, especially Mercosur countries, are extremely fertile, and they would undercut the prices of European producers because Latin American producers are just so much more efficient. The other thing is Brazil. The Brazilian agricultural sector is booming, and part of the reason it's booming is because of deforestation. And so within Europe, we also have environmental groups who are very suspicious or who outright oppose the deal because they think it would encourage further deforestation.
I see.
Yeah, so it's not just the agricultural sector, it's also environmental opposition. And then also you have, it's debatable whether or not this is legitimate. But, you know, what are the standards under which the cattle are raised and whether or not they're healthy, right? So the Europeans have exacting standards. And so, you know, there's kind of a fear that standards would be lowered. Mm. It's a way of creating this sense of, well, you're going to have lower quality goods, which I think is a way to sell this opposition to European voters.
So let's talk about those voters. What are the stakes for them if this goes through or not in both Latin America and in Europe?
It is kind of difficult from a Latin American perspective to look at what's happening and make sense of it because, you know, the Europeans are not surrounded in a world that's friendly to them anymore, right? You have the Americans, like the U.S., imposing tariffs and not becoming a very reliable partner or less reliable partner than it used to be for Europe. And Russia, for example, which used to supply Europe with a lot of these, natural commodities like oil and gas and grains, obviously is not doing that as much anymore. And it's not a reliable partner either. So from the Latin American's perspective, it's like this just makes sense. So the fact that it's being delayed and being opposed so fervently really underscores how powerful some of these interest groups are in Europe.
Mm. You've touched on this just a bit, but I want to follow up more on this. In the last year, the Trump administration has upended global trade. How is that playing into this deal and its progress?
I think for the Europeans' perspective, I think it has really put them in turbocharge mode, right? They need to get something done. This is not a good look. you know, for the Europeans, they really need to get their house in order because there isn't infinite patience. And I think it's important to note that, you know, this the signing of the deal that we're talking about is just the first step, really, of a whole nother set of steps. This is the, this does not mean that the deal is being ratified. There's a whole nother set of, you know, discussions to be had that will take a while. So the fact that you're facing this amount of resistance, just putting signatures on a page, really, I think is disconcerting, I think, from a Latin American perspective.
Nicolas Saldias is an analyst at the Economist Intelligence Unit explaining the potential massive trade deal between Europe and four South American countries that still has not landed. We reached him in Uruguay. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War. And for the last 10 years, musician Vuong Anh Vanessa Va has been bringing her production of The Odyssey from Vietnam to America to audiences all over the U.S. The show is a tribute to the refugees who fled Vietnam in the aftermath of the war. Those refugees became known as boat people. They risked everything, sailing in small, overcrowded boats in search of freedom. In a song called Leaving, relatives of escapees describe the harrowing stories they've been told.
My mom told me how she came here by boat.
Her boat, floating on the ocean towards an unknown destiny.
You hear the voices of boat people themselves, too.
I was scared.
Vanessa Va gathered all of those voices. She described how when we spoke recently.
I interviewed 52 Vietnamese boat people. They shared with me stories like, even up to today, whenever they heard the truck engine with the diesel oil that stop or
an engine that, backfire.
Yeah, then they was in shock because they it took them to the time that when their boat engine died. And the boat engines became their hope. If it died, their hopes went down because their boat couldn't, no longer can run to anywhere, and it's just floating. Or the sound of the sea, the waves, many of us would use that to put us into sleep. But for boat people, that was a horror sound that they don't want to hear anymore.
So you recorded the sounds of those engines and incorporated that into these compositions?
Yes, yes. And wow. I have the music to run and the boat engine and the sound of the ocean just like part of the another instrument in the composition.
Wrote this composition for the 40th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War. We are now at the 50th. Mm-hmm. Has the meaning or significance of this work changed as you've performed it again and again over the past decade?
Yes. So when I first premiered at the Kennedy Centers and in San Francisco, I got a lot of Vietnamese boat people come. The Vietnamese poor people who used to point to my face and said that I am communist because I just purely come from north of Vietnam. I'm from Hanoi. I was born there. But I think that after 10 years with the music and with whatever I try, and many of us have been trying, we be able to heal and make the people to understand more. And maybe forgive. And I hope that music is always a way that for people to channel out, to find a way to make peace with each other and heal each other.
I'd like to play one more song, this one with you singing. It's called Verdant River Delta, before I let you go.
Oh,
This sounds more peaceful, maybe more hopeful than the last piece we heard. What are you expressing in this song?
I think that at the baseline, we don't hate each other. But then, for some reason, things happen, and then war happens. So I just want to use my music to also remind people that we have beautiful things. We have good relationship, and that's the baseline that we should look into to keep it for the future of our generation.
Musician Vân Anh Vanessa Va. Her composition, The Odyssey, commemorates the end of the Vietnam War 50 years ago. Thousands of U.S. military personnel just wrapped up a major combat simulation called Operation Steel Knight. It was conducted at one of the largest Marine bases in the country, Camp Pendleton in Southern California. The point is to train troops in scenarios they could encounter on deployments. As Andrew Dyer reports from KPBS in San Diego, this year's exercises included situations that didn't go well for troops in the past.
The annual exercise Steel Knight this year will certify the 5th Marine Regiment for a rotational deployment to Darwin, Australia. There, the Marine Air Ground Task Force will be ready to respond to anything in the Indo-Pacific.
What we're going for is creating hard, realistic training for the Marines.
First Lieutenant Caleb Corhorn is the weapons platoon commander for Cherokee Company, 1st Battalion, 5th Marines. His platoon is working today at K2 Combat Town on Camp Pendleton.
Thinking back to what happened in the evacuation of Kabul in 2021, the chaos that ensued there, there is an attempt to replicate the same sort of stressors that Marines saw 4 years ago.
To recreate the events, Marines have secured an embassy and stand guard as protesters, actors bussed in by the Marines, put pressure on the guards at the gates. Navy Captain Garfield Cross is the 1st Marine Division surgeon. All the medics in the Marines are Navy corpsmen, and Cross is here to see how they handle a mass casualty event.
They are amazing. They are our strongest asset, to be honest.
Realism is everything during Steel Knight. The Marines are living in the field. After securing the embassy overnight, they were able to sleep indoors.
Some in sleeping bags, some wrapped in a tarp. And then we're all eating MREs.
The exercise was 2 weeks, from December 1st through the 14th. Corhorn and his platoon will move on from the embassy.
And then we're prepared to move to a defensive position later this week. So living conditions will change. We'll be living and fighting out of a hole in the ground that we have dug.
A few miles away at Red Beach, Marines are about to splash into the water from the dock landing ship USS Pearl Harbor. The amphibious landing involves LCACs, short for Landing Craft Air Cushion, and the Corps' new amphibious combat vehicles, or ACVs.
I think it's going well.
Lieutenant Colonel Fred Munday is the commanding officer of the 3rd Assault Amphibian Battalion, which owns all the ACVs on the West Coast. The first deployment of ACVs was pushed back almost 2 years in 2022 after two rolled over in high surf off of Camp Pendleton.
The battalion right now has five elements that are training for deployments, where in the past we were just training for one. So all the things we learned from, you know, you could argue some missteps years ago where we just didn't know.
Tactical vehicles like the ACV are top-heavy and prone to rollovers. Just days before we spoke with Munday, a Marine at Camp Pendleton was killed in an incident with a tactical vehicle. Citing an ongoing investigation, the Marines won't say what vehicle was involved, only saying it was unrelated to Steel Knight. Munday says safety is an important part of planning for any military exercise.
There's safety structure that is in place, so think of safety officers, think of safety briefs, think of all the things to make sure that the Marines know what right looks like and what right does not look like.
The regulations are there, but Munday says there's no denying the work they do is dangerous.
When we focus primarily on safety alone, We may lose sight of the fact that we are preparing to go to war, but I will stand behind the fact that if you do it to the tactical standard, you are inherently safe.
Almost 3,000 sailors and Marines were part of this year's exercise. Infantry from 1-5, along with other elements of 1 Marine Expeditionary Force, will deploy to Australia sometime next year. For The World, I'm Andrew Dyer in San Diego.
For American Jews, celebrating Hanukkah means eating latkes, potato pancakes fried in oil. We wrap things up on this Friday with a story from the archives that Sarah Birnbaum brought us from her own kitchen in Boston.
This has been life at my house for the past 5 nights.
Mister, can we help make some latkes?
I've been eating latkes on Hanukkah for my entire life, and I never gave it much thought until this little guy showed up and started asking,
why?
I know the basics. The story goes, thousands of years ago, a small band of Jewish rebels called the Maccabees defeated the mighty Greek army, which had occupied the land of Israel. The Maccabees made their way back to Jerusalem to reclaim the temple. Part of that was lighting the menorah with consecrated oil, but there was only enough oil to light the menorah for one night. Then something miraculous happened. That oil lasted for 8 nights, and by then they could make more oil. And that's why Jews eat foods fried in oil on Hanukkah. So that's the rough outline. But then I started thinking, why potato pancakes? I reached out to an expert, Tori Avey. She writes a food blog called The Shiksa in the Kitchen.
The potato pancakes that we know today are actually descendants of an Italian pancake known as cassola, which is a fried pancake made with ricotta cheese.
What? I had to look this up on YouTube. It looks delicious, like a blintz crossed with a pancake. But how did cassola become associated with Hanukkah? For this, I consulted the Encyclopedia of Jewish Food by Gil Marks, the Bible, if you will, for this kind of stuff. And he said in the Middle Ages, Jews ate dairy on Hanukkah. Why? Because in the Book of Judith, according to one version of the story, the prophet Judith saves the Jews by luring the Assyrian leader Holofernes with wine and salty cheese. When he passes out, she cuts off his head. Now, what does Judith have to do with Hanukkah? Some say Judith is Judah the Maccabee's aunt or sister, which is impossible because the Judith story is set hundreds of years before the Hanukkah story. So what it probably boils down to is Judith sounds a lot like Judah. So the two stories became conflated. Medieval Jews started eating cheese pancakes on Hanukkah, and the custom spread. But in Eastern Europe, ricotta wasn't readily available, and potatoes were. And most Jews in the U.S. descended from Eastern European Jews. So, to use my best Talmudic voice, that's how you get a potato latke on Hanukkah. Sounds convoluted? Welcome to my people. Okay, time to go back to the guy who set me on this journey. Happy Hanukkah, my lovey.
Happy Hanukkah.
And to you guys out there, happy Hanukkah and B'tei Avon. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a great weekend. See you on Monday.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more, fjc.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.